What are the essentials for a good life? Hi, I'm Steve Donaldson, and this is Thinking Out Loud, an ongoing series of philosophical dialogues with everyday people. The question before us today is, what are the essentials for a good life? Let's begin. We'll start as we usually do with introductions and first reactions. John?
Well, I'm John Titus, and I think it's a wonderful question because we all have to face it or deal with it or come to terms with it in our own lives.
George?
Hi, I'm George Garrett, and this is indeed a question that I think about a lot. I think it comes down to some of our moral views and as well as basic biological ideas. I would venture to say that one quintessential element or would be good health.
Okay.
And then I'll stop there.
Susan? I'm Susan Patrick, and I appreciate this question also. I think it's something we can ponder constantly. My first reaction was some form of moderation and with the flexibility to go far away from that occasionally, mm-hmm. but to keep coming back to moderation.
All right. And Rachel?
Well, I'm Rachel Blackburn, and I think the first thing that struck me is I think I'll be curious by the end of this discussion to see if all of us as a group come up with any standards that we all agree on, since it seems like such a personal, subjective question.
Very good. And Steve Stokes, I'm going to turn it over to you now in cyberspace to go through our cyber guests.
I'm Steve Stokes, and I guess I'm sort of a hedonist, Epicurean kind of person. The essentials for a good life are going to lean in those directions for me. I'm going to start off by saying we should acknowledge that we're pleasure-seeking machines. And so everything flows from that. And I'll point over to David.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the term good life, bene vita. I think that's the key to the discussion.
All right. And we have one more cyber guest. Stephen?
Well, I guess that means me. I'm Steve Whiteman in Atlanta, and the first thing that came to mind was Breyer's ice cream. But but figuring that, you know, Haagen-Dazs or something else would also work, I guess maybe I would move in another direction, which is it seems to me that the only thing that people absolutely have, I mean, other than, you know, food and safety and so forth, that people have to have for a good life is good relationships with other people. And so all the rest of it, I think, ultimately is not as critical as that.
All right, all right. Now we're just going to go for, we're going to call on people as they raise their hands. And I see, John, you have your hand up.
Yes. George mentioned good health, and good health is nice to have, but I don't think it's essential for a good life.
Okay.
Because many people who are in poor health, diabetes or tuberculosis or whatever, have led quite good lives. It's an obstacle, but not an absolute bar to a good life.
Okay. Well, you're bringing up two something that I want to draw some attention to, and it's in part of what David was alluding to. I think there in this question, I want to sort of draw attention to two parts. One is, you know, wrestling with the question, what is a good life? Mm-hmm. But the other part of the question is, what is essential? In other words, and you were addressing that. You were saying, you know, health, and your view was that health is helpful, but not necessarily essential. And so, we can debate that or examine that. I don't want to say debate, examine. But constantly sort of grappling with what does it mean to have a good life, and what if you don't have it, it makes it impossible. I guess that's kind of what I'm thinking the key of that word essential means. So, Steve, any thoughts on cyberspace? On we had some thoughts of health, moderation, relationships. So the question would be, is it possible to have a good life without relationships. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, yeah, I'm ready to speak, and David, I guess, is ready after me. But I want to say that the about good is part of the whole pleasure equation that I would advocate. That if you're in bad health, you're probably in pain, or you're probably restricted from pursuing pleasures, and that is the necessity of good health, is that it is an immediate obstacle to pleasure.
All right.
And that's my point, and David's ready in cyberspace.
All right, David.
Okay, I've taken the liberty to make a list. And here's my list, just off the top of my head. First, I need a peace of mind. I need a sense of myself and a purpose. Three, I need a feeling of gratitude. I need compassion. I need patience. And I need love.
All right. David, just to probe that a little bit more, are these causes or effects?
No, these are essentials for a good life, I think. For me, and I would project them for most people.
Well, for instance, peace of mind, does that come before having a good life, or as a consequence of having a good life?
No, we're talking about essentials for a good life. So in order to have a good life, I think for me, I need these six items.
All right.
I need these six things in my life in order for me to, if I were objectively evaluating my life, these are the things that I would need.
All right, good.
So these are like markers of having a good life.
Is that right, Dave? Oh, we lost the connection, and so we have to wait for them to call back. In the meantime, we can pick up here. George.
I think it'd be very useful for us to distinguish between the two ways of addressing the question. One is, do we look at a good life as a completed entity that we are not in the middle of, but stepping outside of and looking at? The old idea from Solon that you cannot judge a person's life really until it's ended, because otherwise you won't know what the ending is. Very much as we might judge a book or a movie, at least fictional, in that we really have to get to the end to know what to make of the whole. The other alternative is analogous to, again, a movie or a book, in that do we judge it on how it is while we're experiencing it? And if life has ups and downs, and we don't always have all those elements that we're trying to determine here, how much is enough? Do we need to make a good life, or to make a life that is good while we're living it? Because you could sometimes sacrifice things in the moment for things later, and sometimes you're wrong about those. And it's very hard to tell from the inside.
Right.
So well, that's what I would just suggest we frame that. Because I think, to wrap this up, I think what Dave was talking about is a good life as from a whole.
I didn't hear the beginning of your comments.
Hang on that.
He was talking about a good life as a whole,
In
terms of the different parts of it.
Right.
And I think Steve was talking about living life by seeking pleasure.
Right, right. So for the side of guests who just got reconnected here, George was making the point that when judging whether a life is a good life or not, there are really two very different approaches. One is to look back after it's finished, like one would a movie or a book, and to judge it as a whole, which is very hard to do until it's finished. And the other is to make some sort of judgment along the way, in which case it's a little difficult to know how much of a time frame to incorporate. But I need to get that Steve Whiteman in here, because he got cut off earlier. So let's get Steve Whiteman. Go ahead.
Well, let's see. I guess I was, I put my thought to respond to the idea of not requiring good health. It seems to me that's a matter of degree. You know, if you have a condition which is manageable, but which others would say, gee, I wish I didn't have that condition, but, you know, basically it's under control, then I don't think that really counts as bad health. But if you're, you know, if you're sort of in and out of the hospital or if you're in chronic pain or whatever, I can't imagine that you could have what anybody would call a good life. So I think that you do have to have good enough health that it allows you to pretty much carry on the rest of your life unimpeded.
All right. Susan, let me get you in here.
I think there are lots of topics like that we could discuss that would give us a good life, like health and a suitable income and intellectual stimulation and attractiveness. And I mean, there are lots and lots of things that can improve our life, but I was thinking of how to boil it down to like the essential thing. And I've come up with the ability and willingness to be content.
Uh-huh. Ability and willingness to be content. All right. John?
I think Freud said that the essentials of a good life are love and work.
Uh-huh. And how do you feel about that? Do you think he's right? Love and work. Can somebody have a good life without...
can someone have a good life without love, for example?
Well, receiving or giving?
I see it gets giving love. It's not to love and to be loved, they say.
Okay.
And also I'm wondering about people in monasteries. They don't have... I don't know if they have love relationships, but they still supposedly have good lives.
Uh-huh. Okay. I see a lot of, what I want to say, areas to explore that I don't think we'll be able to dig all the way into, but it's interesting that they're coming up in this one question. What is the nature of health? What is love? You know, all these are sort of making this question more difficult as we say these may or may not be essential. Rachel, go ahead.
Well, what Susan said about the willingness and ability to be content, I think, got me thinking along this direction of maybe perhaps what keeps one going is the idea that even if faced with a situation that we don't find suited to our happiness, the feeling of power that one can change that
uh-huh.
situation, or maybe it's a kind of hope
uh-huh.
that I'll continue finding that thing that makes me happy.
Well, I think that's a very powerful word you just introduced in the conversation, hope. And one could say, well, you know, as we look for the essentials, I'd like to draw attention to that as a good candidate. I see we have Steve. Go ahead.
No, Dave's first.
Okay, Dave, you're first. Go ahead.
Yeah, as to the, I'd like to remind you what the question, the topic question was, what are the essentials? Of a good life, not what contribute to a good life. You know, we're starting to mix the two up. And I don't think that health is necessarily an essential to a good life. And I'll give you an example. I have a mother-in-law who is in relatively good health most of her life, but she never had a happy day in her life because she was always, you know, complaining about what she didn't have. I had an aunt who was stricken with polio the day she graduated from nursing school and was wheelchair bound most of her life. She went on to have a career in nursing, two children, and what appeared to be a wonderful life. She was always very happy, always very positive, always giving, loving, and I think that she found what was necessary to have a good life. So I don't think that the obvious things that make up a good life are necessarily the true things that make up a good life.
All right.
Thanks, comment.
Yeah. Steve, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to think about what Dave just said, but I want to respond earlier that the hope, I could see a person having hope through their whole life, but still not having pleasure in their life and having... you know, through this miserable existence, constant hope that, you know, eventually they'll find happiness and pleasure, but they don't because and I would say they didn't have a good life. That hope, hope itself might keep you going, but it isn't a payoff. It's just that thing that keeps you afloat, but it's not the shore that you climb up on at the end. Now, whether people can have happiness and pleasure in the midst of, you know, tough circumstances that other people might think they wouldn't have happiness, I think that Dave's aunt with the polio is a good example of somebody that had pleasures, and therefore they had a good life. Her pleasures were different than what somebody else's pleasures might have been, but I would still say that she had pleasures in her life.
All right.
And hence, good.
All right. Well, on the issue of hope, let me turn it around a little bit for you and ask, certainly, I think the point you were making that hope in itself, from your point of view, isn't sufficient, but is it possible to have a good life without hope? Would be the way to phrase the question, I think, if we're looking at for the essentials. Because the essentials are... Go ahead.
If you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth, you might have pleasures and a good life all the way through without ever needing to hope for anything.
All right.
Yeah, I mean...
All right. let me get Steve Whiteman in here, and then we'll come back to the locals. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, actually, the point I was going to make is the one that you just made, and which is, you know, whether something may be necessary but not sufficient. However, the thing that Steve just responded, I'll have to think about that, you know, where you actually have no need for hope. But then again, has that person had a good life? Maybe so. That wouldn't have occurred to me. I would have thought before that comment that you'd have to have as an essential, you'd have to have some kind of hope, or maybe the word isn't hope. You've got to have some forward looking capacity, I think, because otherwise it seems like you're just if you're just stuck in the present. I understand a lot of people think that's a good thing, but it seems to me if you're not able to look forward, you don't have any sort of hope. That would be hard to imagine that you'd have a good life.
Okay. Let me get back to John.
I'm a little suspicious of hope myself because it's kind of future-oriented. And, you know, according to some religions, the secret of happiness is living in the present.
Yes, that's what Steve was just referring to. Are sympathetic to that philosophy.
Yes, because it's possible to invest too much in your hopes and miss out on the what's available right now.
In the present moment. Okay, George?
I want to reject the idea that pleasure is what is sufficient for happiness, because we get pleasure when we scratch an itch, and if we spend all our time scratching our itches, would we be happy? Rather, I would like to, I think one thing we're arguing about is how much is having a good life, feeling happy or content, how much of it is internal, and maybe there are internal things, and how much of it is external, like we were talking about before, income, wealth, relationships. Can you be, you know, and obviously I think you have to have a combination of both. If you have not, in order for it to be happy, and I would argue that what we should think about is how much is a good life being happy, and how much of it is having certain outward essentials.
Right, it's a little tough there. I mean, basically the question: what is a good life? And that's part of the question, and it's not an easy one to answer. It's just,
well, I still think we have to have the ability to identify goodness that comes to us in order for us to have a good life. Otherwise, we're not going to have a good life. So it boils down to our perception of the world and our reactions to whatever's coming our way. this hope business. I feel like hope is kind of a passive, last-ditch effort, and it's rather passive. We're putting our future into the hands or the powers of something out there. I hope this works out. You know, we're giving up control. I think a better word is confidence.
Uh huh.
And it's more active than hope.
Okay. And I want to point out something that you mentioned that hasn't been explicit yet, but something to do with the word I like is being conscious living. The idea of being aware of goodness when it's there.
Right.
And sort of having this ability to recognize
and appreciate.
And it gets back to what John was talking about, being in the moment, mm-hmm. being present to the goodness that you have in the moment. Mm-hmm. So that's something I think would be good to have in the mix here. I think Dave, go ahead.
I'm coming in. I'm fading in and out, so I want to address the words hope and happiness. You've been talking about hope in the one connotation, which is longing. Hope also has another connotation, is having a positive outlook towards the future. I don't think.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, Debbie, we you're connected.
Still here,
Debbie? Am I connected?
You are connected.
Yeah, Debbie, be quiet. Listen in.
Dave's got the floor. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay. I don't. As I was saying, hope is in the way we're talking about hope now is sort of a longing, which is to me a negative feeling because you're longing that might not happen or you don't have or you want. But hope in the sense of having a positive outlook towards future outcomes is maybe a good way to reframe having a positive a sense of one's purpose or a positive energy to one's life. But again, I think when we're talking about pleasure, happiness, these are not necessarily elements of a good life. A good life can be a life of misery, but if it is perceived as being contributing to the world, to the goodness of the world, like Mother Teresa, most people would not want to live the life that she lived in the black hole of Calcutta. But to her, she was fulfilling a purpose. She was experiencing patience, love, compassion. I had gratitude for her ability to serve others, So when we're talking about a good life, the whole question comes down to what do you mean by good?
Right. Steve, you've been waiting patiently. Go ahead. Steve,
which Steve was it?
Yeah,
it's me. Right.
Steve Stokes, I think, was that's
I wanted to say that on the about passion.
Yes.
Individuals have passions, and this is the source of our drive for pleasure. That it's the fulfillment of our passions that give us pleasure, and this whole question of the essentials of the good life is. It's essential that we fill our passions in order that we could say that our lives were good. And Mother Teresa, her passions were one thing, and she fulfilled them. And so Dave's right when he says that, she had a good life, and although it was entirely different than Hugh Hefner's life, for example.
All right.
I clarify? Said compassion. Not passion. I don't know if that was misinterpreted.
I'm just saying. I'm not trying to quote you, Dave. I'm just saying that to me, Mother Teresa was following out her passion.
Okay.
That's my statement. Yeah, she was following her passion.
Yeah,
but because it was following one mind, I wanted to make sure that I was heard correctly.
David, we know that Steve Stokes is the hedonist, and you're not. So we got the. But in both cases,
I'm a little bit of a hedonist.
Oh, okay. But a word I want to emphasize, because you both used it, and I think it came up a little bit earlier too, is the concept of fulfillment. That might give us help us a little bit on what is a good life if we ask what is a fulfilling life. George, go ahead. You hand up.
Okay, I want to throw out a couple ideas I've got from reading.
Okay.
If you, in terms of a life as we're living it, I would there's a way to think about that in a kind of a matrix format. Whether in two respects, whether you are doing something that is in the present that you enjoy or don't enjoy, and whether you are doing it for the sake of a future event that you want or don't want.
Okay.
And basically, a hedonist is someone who does things in the present but without a view to the future. It's like the grasshopper and the ant story. The grasshopper lives in the present and doesn't have a future. And so that would be the hedonist. The second model, the reverse is the rat race, quote unquote, where you give up pleasure in the moment for the sake of a better life in the future. And of course to round it out, there's the nihilist who has neither pleasure in the past nor is doing anything for the future. Probably depressed is probably better for that. And then what Ben Shahar says is happiness, which is in which you are doing an activity in the present that you enjoy, that you get something out of, but which also contributes to a betterment of your life, or however broadly you want to define that, including other people's lives, the world, etc., in the future. And that really is happiness. And that a life of hedonism, which has been argued, is ultimately not a good life, because it reduces, first of all, it's one more like an animal's life than a human being's. And secondly, it doesn't satisfy over time.
Uh-huh. Okay. A lot of key things. Satisfaction relates to fulfillment, and whether or not the full consciousness or instinctual, I think is a distinction there. If you say animal-like pleasure is not fully conscious awareness of the ramifications or the richness and so forth. So I think I wanted to point that out. I lost track of some of a lot of good points there. John, you had your hand up?
Well, I was thinking we need to distinguish between pleasure and contentment and happiness.
Okay.
Because they are, pleasure for one thing is momentary, always temporary.
Okay.
And it has to be repeated.
Uh-huh.
And contentment is a state of having all your needs physically delivered, satisfied for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
And happiness is more like a kind of spiritual condition.
Okay.
That's what the good life is trying to do.
Could you just talk a little bit louder, please?
Yeah, John was saying the distinction between pleasure, happiness, and contentment, and on the last note, really raising the bar up to questioning whether a good life really is something to do with having a spiritual life. But I remember what George had stimulated me about the question of when you talk about being depressed and the nihilist, how when we were talking about necessity of having good health, well, one of the things we can do is pick apart the concept of health a little bit and distinguish between physical health, which a number of people commented doesn't necessarily prevent you from having a good life, but then one can ask about, well, what about mental health? But I need to get some cyber people back in here. It looks like Steve Stokes first and then Dave. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. I'm wrestling with pleasure versus contentment. And I'm not really seeing a difference. It seems like if I'm experiencing pleasure, I'm going to be content, and any discontentment is going to come from the pleasure being turned off. As I'm eating a good meal, I'm experiencing the pleasure of eating a good meal. And then after the meal, I'm full and I'm content, but it's a very pleasurable feeling, this feeling of being full. So, I don't know, is contentment not a subset?
Let's leave that open for a moment, because I want to get Dave in, and then we'll cycle through again, and maybe somebody can respond to that. But go ahead, Dave.
Okay, well, again, we're talking about essentials to a good life, and you're talking about pleasure. And in my thinking, pleasure is not an essential. It may be a byproduct of having a good life. And consider this. A pedophile feels a perverse pleasure when he sees naked children. Is that a good life?
Well, I mean, we can go to the extreme aberrant person. Let's look at, say, 80% of the population and not go out on the fringe. I mean, to pick apart my position on pleasure being the central core to an essentially good life.
Okay, you're fading in and out. I'm not sure if that's on our end or on your end. It does relate to the question of what is a good life. And Rachel, go ahead.
Maybe one thing that's my mind keeps jumping back and forth in between is, who are we using to define this good life? Are we saying that the individual sees his or her life as a good life, or that we looking in on this life define it as a good life of someone else?
Yeah. Is there an objective viewpoint on what is a good life? That's a key question. Steve, are you waiting? Go ahead, Steve.
I can't hear
Steve
when we're talking.
Steve with a thumbs up, so I assume that's Steve Stokes. Or was that Steve Whiteman?
No, that's Steve Whiteman.
Steve Whiteman, then.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, I put my thumb up 10 minutes ago, so I was referring then. I'm not kidding. Go back and look.
Yeah. Well, we've got a lot of great ideas tonight, so I appreciate your patience.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I guess at one point we were talking about sort of Steve Stokes' hedonism, and I wanted to point out that if you know him, you'll know that his hedonism is theoretical, not practical. The thing that I would point out that I mentioned earlier is that I think all of this is irrelevant if you don't have relationships. I can't imagine someone living by himself having what I would ever call a good life. Now, once you have the relationships, then the next important thing is having something that you care about to pursue. Whether it's your work or a hobby or the relationship, it's something that you care about, that when you get up in the morning, you're excited about it and you pursue it with enthusiasm. But I think the most important thing is relationships. I can imagine having a good life if I have a good relationship or a series of them with other people without really having a passion. I can still imagine having a good life, but having a passion, but being isolated or without relationships, I can't imagine that's a good life.
Well, I'm tempted to see if I can paraphrase that in a very short way, because it struck me as you were speaking that what you're saying, perhaps, is what you need is something to do and someone to do it for, which strikes me as a very nice way of putting it. Let's see. I think Debbie. Let's get Debbie in here. She hasn't spoken yet. Go ahead. This is Debbie Martin from Boca Raton, Florida. Go ahead, Debbie.
Right. I'm sorry that I had to come into the discussion late.
That's all right.
But I just wanted to add, if this is. I hope I'm on the right track with what you've all been talking about earlier, but, what makes for a good life is, so I don't know if there's an objective, way of putting it, because it's very subjective, but I was going to say it's so different for each person. In other words, I think some people think it's a good life to say, you know, maybe be married and have, you know, a large sum of money and be able to buy a lot of things, be able to do a lot of things, and, you know, and maybe their day-to-day conversation never really goes past that too much. It's just, you know, where do they go to eat and what do they buy, and et cetera, et cetera. And that to them is having a good life because they've, you know, accomplished certain goals that they had, you know, whether it's being married or having kids or whatever, you know, living in a big house. To someone else, that would be ludicrous, you know, oh, that's having a good life, but, you know, they're not thinking, they're not, you know, they're not talking about any philosophical issues, they're not taking any kind of classes, they're not watching interesting foreign films. I mean, they're, you know, I mean, so it's so, you know, it goes from A to Z. I mean, it's such a wide spectrum of what could comprise a good life for somebody. You know, I wouldn't be very, you know, satisfied with some of these different examples, but I know other people, and they seem to be very satisfied living that kind of life, and it's sometimes sort of mind-boggling because it seems like it would be so boring, you know, but to them, I'm sure it's not.
All right.
So that was
good.
You know, that's
good. Well, it raises our concept that yet another one for our line of thinking, which is the idea of different definitions of a good life for different people. And what struck me is perhaps in different stages of life or different levels of growth. And the idea of growing is something that we might want to consider. I need to get the order back. I think I skipped over Steve Stokes. So Steve Stokes, did you want to get in?
Yeah, because I think what Debbie just said is exactly in line with me saying that fulfilling your passions is essential to the good life, and different people have different passions.
All right.
Steve Whiteman was sort of saying, I think, in support also.
Yeah, okay. And then Dave, I think, is next, and then we'll get back to our roundtable here. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, the question was raised, is a good life
I lost you. Can't
hear. I think there is the consensus of any culture will define a good life, and each individual also defines a good life, and somewhere in between I think we can come to understand what a good life is. When the question is first posed, you know, I saw that as the crux of the conversation, not you know, pleasure or passion. I think these are all peripheral to the question. And the more I look at the six things that I listed as defining my sense of good life, the more I think that they tend to be universal.
All right, all right. I'm not sure the order here. Maybe John?
Yes, I don't think passion is not always good or constructive.
Uh-huh.
So you have to say what kind of passion you need. For example, Hitler was a passionate man.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear it again.
Speak
up in the mic.
I said Hitler was a passionate man.
So, and you were saying it's important to distinguish between different kinds of passion. Mm-hmm. Well, Dave was making the same point too. A pedophile,
yeah,
having a passion, mm-hmm, that we wouldn't say is something a good model for living a good life. And I think George mentioned earlier about the idea of animal living on sort of instinctual level,
mm-hmm,
but Steve Stokes pointed out that if you take the word passion in a different sense, that Mother Teresa had a passion for giving and serving. So, mm-hmm, so it is a tricky word. George, let me get you in here.
I just want to follow up on Rachel's point and the one we're making is talking about two different things here. And we're getting mixed up. We're talking about what would a good life be for me,
right?
And by extension, I'm not going to judge what someone else thinks is a good life for him or her. Rather, or let's look at someone else's life and say, was that a good life, or even is that a good life if you want to? And as soon as we do that, as soon as we look at somebody else's life, we add a third element, not just their own happiness, but the morality, how has their life been in its relation to the world, and not quite apart from ourselves, it may not be. And I think we would agree that, for example, and I don't think it's a French example, but I think it's a good example, the person who they just caught recently who murdered a bunch of people over the weekend, kind of on a crazy rampage, the newspaper said that he was a loving father and he really loved his kids and he had a wife and he just kind of went nuts. I mean, I don't know what happened, okay, but the point is, from his internal, from internally, he probably had good and bad moments. But there's no way we could say, looking from the outside, that he had a good life because he killed a lot of people unnecessarily, and therefore we have to judge someone else's life that way. But we don't think of that in judging our own life. Are we leading a moral and good life?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you bring me back again to the concept of mental health and
right.
And the relationship between mental health and a good life. And the idea of mental. What do you want to call it? Psycho-spiritual personal growth.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a long phrase to talk about the internal world, one's internal world, how that relates. And is there an objective path? So it's not just arbitrary that anybody could be living a good life if he says he's living a good life. I think an important question that deals with whether it's purely relative or if there is some system, some absolute. I have three cyber people I need to get in here. Debbie, you're next.
I was just wondering earlier, was it Dave that had said there were, and I'm sorry because I missed that, but that there were six components of having a good life that he thought were universal?
Dave had a list that he came up with for himself. Would you like to hear those? Or do you have a comment?
Sure, that's okay, yeah.
Yeah, Dave, you want to go ahead and list those for Debbie?
Sure. First was peace of mind. Second was sense of purpose for oneself. Third was a feeling of gratitude. Fourth was a sense of compassion. Fifth was patience. And sixth was love.
Okay, Debbie, and what are your thoughts?
Thank you.
Or you wanted to add anything, or do you want to pass it on to Steve Whiteman would be next. Do you have anything?
Yeah, that's okay. Let me go ahead with Steve.
Okay, Steve Whiteman, go ahead.
Well, let's see. People were talking a while back about having a passion, and then that idea was criticized because, you know, Adolf Hitler had a passion. And sort of two comments there. First, you have to distinguish between necessary but not sufficient. You know, if passion is not sufficient to a good life, it doesn't mean it's not necessary. But the other thing is that, you know, where would philosophy discussions be without Adolf Hitler? I think we should all thank him, for having existed. I think it really raises, and this question has come up, but I think it's worth addressing directly, whether a good life is subjective or objective. I mean, can you say, let's say that, you know, the moment that that he successfully invaded Poland, he was on the top of the world. If we don't judge his entire life, because after having shot himself, he probably wouldn't have said he had such a good life. But after he invaded Poland, if you had asked him, does he have a good life, he'd probably say yes, but would we?
Mm-hmm.
And if we would say no, then that lends credence to the argument that it is not a subjective thing, that it is objective. But I think that's worth discussing, because I'm not sure if I think it's objective for something, but if you're willing to tell Adolf that he hasn't got a good life because you judge that he's, you know, immoral, and then that's something that's, objective and not subjective.
Right, right. Well, there's two parts to that, I think, that you're pointing out, that one can wrestle with whether it's subjective or objective, but then when we get to, if we do decide it's objective, then the question is, what is the criteria then? I mean, there is, but one can conclude that it's objective and without having necessarily nailed down exactly what that system is. I think that's a good question. But let me get Steve Stokes is waiting next, and then Dave. Go ahead, Steve Stokes.
I'm trying to reconcile the two polarities between the internal evaluation that somebody might say about their life being good and the external evaluation of everybody else looking in at that life saying whether it was a good life or not. I'm trying to reconcile, you know, somebody who is destructive to me and offends my sensibilities, I'm going to have a tendency to say they're not being a good person. It's a very subjective evaluation of them, but it's a very real one. You know, I'm going to say Hitler wasn't a good person, therefore he couldn't have been living a good life, could he? But then internally, you know, Hitler was passionate and believed that he was doing his best for mankind and certainly doing best for his fellow Germans and maybe he felt he was doing the best for the whole world by eliminating what he saw as undesirable elements in it. So he reconciled those two things. And maybe I should just back away and try this from a different tact and say maybe Socrates was right when he hinted to us that the unexamined life is not worth living. So maybe that's the one element that's essential for good life is being philosophic about life. That going through life with the philosophic sense of examining life as you go through it is what is essential to living a good life.
All right.
Another element might be living a moral life. Mm-hmm. That if you're an immoral person, you cannot live a good life. That it's essential that you live morally. If, like I define it as the monologue, then that's part of it. So I'll go on. Dave, I think, is next in cyberspace.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, and I'm going to keep bringing us back to the question. The question was, what are the essentials to a good life? And we're talking about a lot of things that aren't necessarily essential to a good life, whether you're talking about a subjective view of one's life or an objective view of from a cultural standpoint. And the term good is so fraught with ambiguity. I mean, we could have used so many different adjectives to state the question, but because it's such an open-ended question, we have to deal with an open-ended way. And I think that, and I'll reiterate the point that I made just a while ago, is that if we're going to deal with the question as it's stated, we have to deal with both the subjective view of one's life and the objective view of, you know, the life of a human's life from a cultural standpoint. And we have to, not separately, but together.
Okay. I'm going to get the local contingent back in here. Susan, you had your hand up earlier.
Uh-huh.
Still?
Yeah, everyone's been talking about these extraordinary people from history, and most of us aren't that type. We're not those people. What about the person who might have an IQ of 90 and wakes up every morning happy to start the day and does good deeds and doesn't do anything spectacular and has no passion, but keeps it steady and progresses through life and brings pleasure to people. Isn't that a good life?
Well, you bring up the point that came up earlier about making a distinction between where people might be in their life or in the spectrum of possibilities, and certainly. What a good life for I'm just going to use age as an example. I'll say a good life for a 2-year-old or a good life for a 10-year-old, you know, it would be different than, you know, if at, 40 you're behaving like a 2-year-old. You know, I always say it's nothing wrong with acting like a 2-year-old if you really are 2 years old. So that may be something we have to take into account is the context. But even in the context, my personal gut feeling is it's not totally relative. There's still a direction, and you can be on course or off course. Even so, it's not so much how far along the course you've gone, but whether you're on course or off course, that might be a kind of compass to whether you're in, you know, leading the good life at the moment. Any other hands here? Rachel.
Well, maybe I hesitate to go here, but something that you were saying earlier about, I think it was the example of the man that had killed a lot of people, but was apparently also in his life a good father and loving and other things. I think that's an interesting thing because when I was starting to think about, well, how would I view someone else's life as being good or not good, I was thinking along the lines of, well, what do they leave more good than harm in their wake?
Uh-huh.
But then I think that's a dangerous, mm-hmm. very gray path to go on, and I hesitate to even say that because it's so subjective.
And it's one of those things like a good book or a good movie. How long do you wait to look back to get the right perspective? But let's see, I think Steve Whiteman was the next in cyberspace to go. So go ahead, Steve.
Well, I wanted to respond to what Steve Stokes said. He mentioned two possibilities that might be essentials. One might be a philosophical outlook, and the other might be a moral, living a moral life. Now, a philosophical outlook, I think if you have that as a requirement, then I'm sure 99% of all the people who've ever lived could not be said to have had a good life, and I can't imagine that would be the truth. On the other hand, I can buy that because if someone is sort of fundamentally immoral, I can't imagine that they would have lived a good life. So philosophical outlook, no. I think the person that we just talked about, the person who, whether they've got a 90 IQ or not, if they just sort of get up and live their life and are good to other people and so on, I think that person very easily could live a good life and never have a philosophical thought. But I do think that they have to be moral.
All right. Next would be Debbie. Go ahead, Debbie.
Okay. This is kind of going back a little ways, but when you've got a couple of times had mentioned having good mental health or having your mental health,
uh-huh.
I was going to say I think that may be a component, but not necessarily, I guess, when you say mental health, there could be some kind of, problems or just a mental health issue that someone could have. They could be missing a portion of their, you know, brain, and that's not necessarily not mentally healthy, but I mean, there could be aspects of mental health that were abnormal, but the person was still, you know, basically a happy person and sort of along the lines of what Steve Whiteman said, living a good life. But I think that they have to have enough mental health there that either they're not, that it hasn't been skewed by the fact that all of a sudden they're violent or they're very aggressive or one of those kinds of ill mental health situations. So you have to have a reasonable amount of your mental health, I think, has to be a component. You can't have any severe, how would I want to classify it, abnormalities that would, you know, make the person have extremely poor judgment or have, you know, aggressive or violent tendencies because of a mental health issue that they had, such as if they were,
I think you're taking even further, and rightly so, what I was doing earlier when I took health and distinguished between some physical disabilities and emotional problems, and you're further taking,
right.
Mental health can further be dissected, and some kinds of mental disabilities should not be impairments to living a good life.
Right.
And what I was thinking in terms of is that this certain subset, the ones that might make you severely depressed or anxious or filled with anxiety, it's hard for me to picture somebody having a good life if they're tormented. And so that
right.
was what I was thinking, but you're right in pointing out that that's just a subset of the various mental conditions one could have that are impairments. Let's see, I need
right.
to get Steve Stokes in, and then Dave, and then we'll get back to the local here. So Steve Stokes.
I've got two things. I hope I remember them both. I think it was Susan's guide that she put out as an example. I wanted to ask Susan if her impression of this person was that he was fulfilling his passions, that whatever passions he had, he was fulfilling them. I mean, it sounded like he was, because he was making the people in his life happy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, yeah, you're getting back to the problematic word passions. Can be taken.
Well, it's problematic for other people, but for me, it is central.
I
don't like it being said that this is not an essential to the good life, because for me, fulfilling your passions, following your passions, is the core to living a good life.
A word that I've heard that you may to describe this particular kind of passion is bliss. I've heard the phrase "follow your bliss." The idea of you having something that means something to you that's worth pursuing. I think that's what you're referring to.
Well, bliss to me doesn't sound the same as passion. Bliss seems like a state of being, that you're in a state of bliss. Passion is a driving force. So I like the word passion and want to keep using it. Now, the second point was, I just wondered if the group had some sort of feeling as to what percentage of the human population lives the good life. Are more people now in this point in history living the good life than, say, 1,000 years ago in the medieval times? What percentage of people were living the good life? And does something like being flooded out in Katrina or in the Mississippi River Basin, does that mean, I think that those people have they're losing some of their passions because of the hardships of the environment. And so they're having a depressed life because of the bad. You know, if an earthquake wipes out your family or a tsunami comes along, it's very hard to live a good life when you've been wiped out like that.
All right. Now we're getting close to the end here. I do have, Susan, you had a comment. Did you want to make a comment or add?
Yes, this person I was describing who just finds pleasure in every day, I was thinking maybe she did not have passion. She just had an interest in enjoying her situation. It was more low-key. I think passion is being something that might kind of drive out other interests and be very strong and kind of overpowering.
Okay. So that one's still open. George, you had your hand up, and I'm going to just kind of let you have the last word here then, because then we'll have to wrap it up. So,
throw out this idea. If you talk about a good life in the terms of external factors, any of us here is living a far better life than the greatest kings and queens of all the way up until probably the 20th century in terms of health, physical comfort, protection from, lifestyle, air conditioning, items, communication, knowledge. Obviously, we don't have power and we don't have status, which are And you can argue, how much of those make a good life. But I would argue that in those external materialistic factors I described, the people nowadays are happier than, at least in people who have them here in the West, than ever in human history, and more so than the most happy people of the past.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, we'll leave it on that note because we're out of time. So I want to say thank you to all the participants for sharing your thoughts, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. For more information about this show and how you, the listener, can participate on the show, visit our website at www.citizenphilosopher.com. Until next time, this is Steve Donaldson wishing all of you the joys of philosophical reflection. And remember, thinking is a good thing, and everyone has a right to enjoy it.